This is the Go Big Real Estate Podcast, Episode 8.
Welcome to the Go Big Real Estate Podcast, helping you unlock your real estate potential and develop a Go Big mindset. Go Big mindset. Here's your host, Army officer turned real estate investor, Hunter Locke. Hunter
Locke. Hey, how's it going, Go Big listeners? This is Hunter Locke, and I'm your host and your guide. Today, I have an awesome interview with Scott Price. Scott, it's a little bit longer for good reason because Scott's got a lot of awesome stuff to say. We wish I had longer. He's got an awesome background that you can read about in the show notes. And he bought and managed his first rental property in '94, and had a lot of. He just recently, I think a year and a half to 2 years ago, went full time in real estate investing. Could have done it a lot sooner, but he's got a really diverse career background. It's really interesting, including, you know, team managing, project managing, marketing, a lot in the tech space, and even as a U.S. diplomat living in Europe, which is an awesome addition to that. And he ramped up his real estate investing alongside of work starting in around 2003 after that first one in '94. So currently he's an active real estate investor. He owns multifamily, single family rentals, office space, retail, medical, and land throughout Washington State. His prior background is as a real estate manager, team manager, program manager, consultant, team leader, and he's been in a lot of large companies, startups, and the public sector in the tech arena. And then looking back to around 2007, he timed the market and got out of full-time real estate sales and returned to his background in team management while simultaneously leveraging the changing markets opportunities. And then he's consistently increased the holdings of his cash flowing portfolio. And he's definitely a buy and hold long-term, hold it for cash flow investor. He's went on to manage a global real estate programs within the International Real Estate Group at one of the world's largest and most valuable companies. So as you can tell, he's got a diverse background. He's a wealth of information. I love talking to him. I feel like he could talk real estate all day long. He's got a great outlook on lifestyle, on life. He's in the Northwest Washington area. He lives on a cool little island. You know, I nerd out a little bit about the Northwest, and it's just an awesome interview. He's currently focused with his wife on their company that they started, their investing company named Bonvolo, and check out the show notes to learn more about that. And without further ado, here's my interview with Scott Price. Scott, well, thanks for coming to the show today, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Hunter.
Well, we've been talking a little bit. I'm a little bit jealous of your geography, like we've been talking about it, emailing back and forth. So can you, let's just indulge me right in the beginning and just talk about how do you like living in the Northwest, and let's talk about, you know, nothing to do with real estate, but how is it living up there in that part of the country?
Sure. Yeah, I love it. I moved out here about 20 years ago, actually, and I moved out here because of location. The whole country was open to me, and I said, where do I want to live? Based on location, not based on the job. And I chose the Seattle area. And once I moved here, then I got even more specific. And we now live on an island that's northwest of Seattle. It's called Whidbey Island, and that's our prime spot that we've picked after a number of years of getting out and about. And we're real outdoorsy, me and my wife, and a lot of our friends. So we really like this environment because you've got mountains to see and everything in between.
Now, is it when you say living on an island, is it? It's not like you have to take a boat every day, right? Is there a bridge or what is it?
If you went to Seattle, yes. And for a little while, I commuted. I had a telecommute job with a tech company, and I arranged it so that I could work 4 days a week at home, and one day a week I had to go in, and that was about a 5-hour round trip. So that was quite a commitment, but I just caught up on podcasts and books, and I only had to do it usually one day a week. But there is a bridge on the north end, but that's pretty far away from Seattle. I usually on the south end of the island is a ferry you have to take.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've spent a little bit of time, like I was telling you, at Fort Lewis, and I loved being there, looking at Mount Rainier every day. That's amazing. So anyways, just trying to get that out of the way, because I knew I had to talk about it. But why don't you tell everybody a little bit about who you are and what you do and where you come from?
Sure. So yeah, I've been investing in real estate for 14 years now, and I'm a full-time real estate investor. So for about 12 and a half of those years, I basically worked two jobs, meaning I worked another job in various companies. And then I had my evening and weekends job gradually building my real estate portfolio. And that was always part of the grander plan. My wife and I actually have a vision board that we put together 15 years ago. And part of it was that our income was going to be coming completely from real estate. And so I just got on that path. And now I am doing it full time for about the last year and a half. And it's a combination of things in terms of what we've gotten into. We currently own multifamily, office, retail, singles, and some land. And we've been in all those asset classes for a while. So we're still gradually adding to our portfolio. We're now at the point, especially now that I'm full time, where I've branched out into syndications as well as some coaching. So kind of now that I have the time for it, I'm not working a 9-to-5 job. I can even devote more effort to it, which is great. But I still have a lot of control of my time, which is actually the original point, of course.
Now, I definitely want to circle back to that vision board thing, because I like to talk about mindset a lot on this podcast. And but before we do that, what did you do before real estate? I think you said your bio says you're from Maryland, or you were from Maryland prior to. What did you do before real estate, and what got you interested in it in the first place?
Yeah, so really until a year and a half ago, I was primarily with various tech companies, and I was usually in either program management or team management positions, and it worked a number of places, some big household names that you'd recognize and a few startups that you probably wouldn't recognize, so kind of all the way from one end to the other, and even did some government work as well, so quite a range. And really going way back, answering the second part of your question as far as why I got into real estate, I looked at early on, even out of college, I looked at, okay, what do I want to do with my life? Not just my job, not just looking at, okay, what am I going to do this weekend? Those kinds of things. But what do I want to do in the much bigger picture? And I actually, from an early age, I read books on stocks when I was 12. I've always been interested in business. I even bought my first stocks when I was 12. I had a little side business mowing lawns. I bought a car when I was 12 to flip it. All these kinds of things. So I've kind of been into entrepreneurial things for a while, and quickly, even in high school, just researching how people made money so that they could control their lives and their lifestyle and not be at the whim of a company or having to work a 9-to-5 and things like that, it became apparent to me that you've got all of the big name people out there that make $1 billion and through some IPO of some stock, and that's great, and that's one path. Although my general observation was that it was a little bit of a roll of the dice, because there were a lot more people who tried the same path and were not successful at it. Whereas I also saw there were a lot of people who were not household names, but they got rather wealthy, both from an income perspective as well as a net worth perspective through real estate. And investigating that even further, it really came down to, this is doable. Anybody can do it, but you've got to persevere. You've got to get knowledgeable. You've got to not just go and buy some guru's package and let it sit on your shelf and not do anything about it and all this kind of stuff. But if you do it and if you stick with it, it's very possible and feasible. And so I started along that path. I didn't want to leave my life up to the chance of maybe being in a company that might do incredibly well. I wanted to be more in control myself, and real estate was that path.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like an awesome story of, and I've talked about this time and again with guests, is that you found something that you You decided what you wanted, and then you architected your life in order to achieve it. And that probably brings us back to that vision board. Can you tell me a little bit about that process? I think you said you and your wife made it together. I mean, what does that look like? I've seen a lot of different types. You know, what did that look like for you, and how did you use that as a tool to, was it to keep you motivated or what?
Yeah, it was actually pretty fundamental in terms of putting that together and really being intentional about where we wanted to go. And, not just, oh, maybe I'd like to do something and maybe I'd like to take a vacation somewhere or, you know, something like that, but to think bigger than that and think about just the big things. Where do we want to live? What's the environment we want to live in? What's the kind of income we want? What do we want in terms of flexibility in our time and our pastimes and our hobbies and family and all that kind of stuff? And what we did was we created there are different kinds of vision boards. Ours was graphical. And what I mean by that is, it's a large poster. It's up in our office, and it's a collection of images, and each image represents a goal, essentially. And I find that kind much more interesting because you look at it, it's more visually appealing than something that's word-based, and also it has a little more emotion to it because you get these, you know, really beautiful pictures of, you know, where you eventually want to live, or, you know, what your house look like, or, you know, where you want to travel to or whatever. And we created that together. We actually, a few months ago, we realized we had achieved not everything, but a good portion of everything on our original vision board. So we actually revisited it. We actually took a weekend away, and my daughter stayed with my father, and we revisited it and updated it because that's important to do, especially after you get to a point where you've achieved at least a number of them, not everything, but, you know, but a number of them. And then the most important thing is that a vision board by itself is good and it gets you thinking about it, but it can be like a New Year's resolution where that sounds great, but most people don't follow up, you know, or they follow up for a month and then they trail off. So what we do is we have a weekly meeting, and we get together, and it's based around a couple of things, just what's going on in our lives right then. But on top of that, we actually bring it back to our vision board. We actually look at topics or subjects on that vision board and say, this week, what are we doing on certain things? Every single week of our life, we're not working on every goal. I'm not saying that, but we're saying, okay, you know what, we want to be intentional about it. And then on a daily basis, my wife and I have a different approach on this. It's just, you know, it's personal preference. My approach on the daily basis is I actually print out, because I like having something physically on my desk. I did electronic too, and I'm kind of a tech guy, but I found that paper worked really well for me. So I have a clipboard, piece of paper on my desk, and it has my goals, and it says, what am I going to do today for that goal? And then there's columns on the right that says yes, no, or yes, partial, no. And that means yes, I did that today that I said I was going to do this morning. I did a little bit of it, which is partial, and no, I didn't do it. So I better get on it tomorrow because I did not do what I said I was going to do today. You know? So I kind of grade myself as well. And I do that pretty much every day. You know, if I'm on vacation or something, of course I'm not, but I do that pretty much every day. And that's the important element is making it a daily practice, not just making it a big vision that just sits there on your, and it becomes part of the wall, you know, it kind of blends into the paint. You got to make it actionable.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's some good quote about, you know, vision without action is just a hope or something like that. You definitely got to translate that crystal clear vision into action. So that's cool. Well, that's inspiring. My wife and I are going through that process right now. So it's just, I'm jumping on that, trying to get the details out because I think it's important. And it's cool to see somebody on the other side of that, you know, visioning exercise for sure. So you said you're going to be updating it for the next phase of your life? Or you already did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. We've got we have the updated goals. We have to next put it into the poster or the vision board. So we've got it written out. I'm already using it on my daily basis sheet, but we've got to go through the, it's a little harder to put together a nice vision board. So I mean, it just takes a little more time, you know?
Yeah. I'm not the best at arts and crafts. I'm worried about, you know, I want it, you know, framed and, and perfect. And anyways, so bringing it back to real estate, what is your company? What's your company called, and what kind of deals are you guys taking down right now? You mentioned syndications. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. Yeah. So my company is Bonvolo Real Estate Investments, and we've almost entirely up to now have been self-funding. And what I mean by that is we've been doing our own deals using our own money and from prior deals, rolling them forward into bigger deals and basically creating a snowball effect. And we've been doing that for 14 years. And a combination of things. You know, we'd sell something and move the profits forward in 1031, or we'd cash out refi and keep a property, but then, you know, use the money to roll forward, or we'd use just the income from it and use that to buy another property, or, you know, all those kinds of things. And when you add that up over time, it becomes a bigger and bigger, increasingly larger snowball effect where you can buy larger and larger properties. And that's what we've done up to now. And now that I'm full-time, now we're getting into syndication. I've worked with some private investors before on some of my deals as well, but more formally getting into that. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with syndication, it's basically investing with co-investors, and where I would be essentially doing all the work, meaning, you know, selecting, acquiring, managing, all that kind of stuff. And then the investors would be passive. They would get passive either monthly or quarterly income, as well as the net worth that the property would increase in over time.
Now, can you walk me through a recent deal and kind of what it looked like? I guess just pick multifamily. I'm guessing you got a lot of that in your portfolio. By the way, your portfolio seems it struck me as very diversified. I'm surely you did that on purpose, but just generally, you know, you see people are mostly focused in multifamily or mostly focused in office. Was that an intentional decision to spread yourself out?
I would say it was more opportunistic. And what I mean by that is I felt confident enough because I had done extensive research, done a lot of reading, gone to a lot of meetups, met a lot of people who were in office or retail or multifamily or things like this when I was starting out, and had a good support group of people to ask questions and actually to follow along with what they were doing. And it got to the point where I felt pretty comfortable, you know, even to start. Now I feel very comfortable because I've actually done it, but I felt pretty comfortable actually getting into different asset classes. I didn't want to get into anything too esoteric, you know, too strange. Like I not that it's esoteric, but for instance, I don't really look at warehouse and industrial. It just hasn't been in, you know, interest of mine. But I am interested in self-storage, though I have not done that yet, you know, so that I might have another asset class on my books here soon. But really, it amounted to knowing enough about the local market, the local drivers, like in office and retail, how are businesses doing? What could be a replacement business for the current tenant? Things like that. And it was good returns, good solid current tenants, long-range leases, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I started getting out of the more traditional residential multifamily and started spreading out when I saw really good deals, especially in the last cycle, you know, in the, you know, 2009 to 2011 period. It was, you know, everything went down, not just multifamily. So,
and what kind of, just for listeners to set kind of a scale, let's say what kind of deal are you talking about when you're talking about raising money and bringing on investors? What kind of, can you just kind of describe what a typical deal might look like for you?
Sure. Yeah. And like I said, this is something we're getting into. So I've got a number of investors who want to invest with us. We're just actually in the process now that I'm, you know, actually last year, my full-time job was building our home. So I took a little bit of a break. So now starting the beginning of this year, I'm now ramping back up on all this. But what it will be is oriented to multifamily primarily. A lot of investors can understand that better, feel more comfortable about it, and it's so the conversation is easier in terms of the investor feeling comfortable with it. A lot of people are concerned about office and retail for valid reasons, and there's still really good deals in those areas, but a little bit more risk in some cases. So, you know, multifamily tends to be the better one at this point. The flip side on that is that it everybody wants multifamily now, and the returns are, you know, it's harder to find the really good returns. So I'm starting to dig deeper and deeper because, you know, anybody can buy a multifamily. It's a matter of finding one that actually has an appealing return. So, and in terms of the type of property, we are primarily in Washington State just because I'm so familiar with it. I have been out of state and, but I've currently sold, what I've had out of state, but that doesn't say that I'm, you know, that I'm staying in state. I'm actually looking back out of state again, partly because I can find some better cash flow outside of Washington than inside of Washington. So, you know, I'm going where the opportunity is. And it would generally be, I would say, you know, just as a ballpark thing, likely an apartment complex in the 100 to 300 unit range, and likely a B, C, a class, you know, a class B or class C, property, and hopefully something with a bit of a value add opportunity or under market rents or things like that. Those are the kinds of things I've bought for myself, and they tend to give you the best returns overall.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you mentioned the Washington market. That was one of my questions. What's your broad outlook on the market in Seattle and nationwide? Let's focus on multifamily just for simplicity. I mean, what are your thoughts on your local and national markets?
Yeah, locally, especially in the Seattle area, very strong, still strong, a little bit of an oversupply situation potentially in the Class A new construction area, although that frankly has occurred in a lot of places because a lot of builders can only build Class A because the construction costs are so high they can't build something that would pencil for a Class B or C type unit. So starting to run into that a bit in Seattle, but there's still lots of demand. There's a whole bunch of people coming in, and it's becoming a second San Francisco in terms of, you know, as a tech hub. So it has a lot of demand. The flip side or the consideration though is, like, for instance, I personally do not own anything in Seattle, and there's two issues there. Number one, it's not a landlord friendly city, number one, and it just, some of the rules are difficult for landlords, and they're getting worse. They haven't been getting better. So that's one issue. But the bigger issue actually for me is there's a lot of money there, and people tend to spend in their backyards. So people are just paying very low cap rates, meaning getting very low returns. And when you add conventional financing on it, they basically don't even have any cash flow. It's, you know, in Seattle. So what I do is I go to stronger outlying markets, still in Washington, but not in the Seattle metro, not in the immediate Seattle metro. And I'm looking for smaller towns that have a diversified base of employers, have some growth to them, a path of progress kind of stuff going on, local investment going on, good renter demographic and good renter demand, you know, things like that. I always start at the market level and go down from there. And there's a number of markets that I just keep an eye on, and all my stuff is in outlying markets, you know, around Washington. It's all in secondary and tertiary markets.
And in terms of, just to dovetail on that, from a national perspective, when the people talk about a correction in multifamily, or, you know, coming around out of the current cycle, you know, how can multifamily investors protect themselves? You know, the conversation is obviously, you know, looking at fundamentals, you know, buying for cash flow. I mean, what kind of things are on your mind in terms of protecting yourself against, you know, maybe the 5-year outlook on a national scale?
Yeah, that's really important. I've purchased some multifamily recently, and I've also refied, done some cash out refinances on some of my property. Again, the same idea I talked about earlier, get some cash out, have a slightly higher mortgage payment on that property, which reduces the NOI on that property, but I can invest the funds in another property and make more money than the increased mortgage payment on the first property, and continue to build my portfolio. So the reason I say that is because those are all things on my mind as well. So, you know, you got to be thinking, okay, you know, buying now and I'm financing, refinancing now. So I'm looking at a couple things on the financing side. And again, why I mentioned that is I'm even though I'm paying a bit higher interest, I'm getting as long as I can on the fixed period. And normally in commercial, you can get longer, and there are programs out there longer, but normally it's like in the 10 to 12 year time frame is normally the longest you can get. I've seen 15, I've seen all the way up to 30 year, you know, that is fixed. But at the same time, just for most programs, actually most programs out there are usually in the 5 year frame, but time frame, but I don't consider those. I'm looking for a longer time frame. And that's really to get through the period that you're talking about if and when it occurs. So, you know, I don't want to be in a position where the property value has gone down and then I need to come out of pocket to refi because I'm now refinancing on a lower value. And I'm generally buy and hold. I have sold a few properties recently, and the only reason I've sold them recently, I'm almost exclusively buy and hold, but essentially it was literally a situation where somebody wanted me to pay a price that I wouldn't pay that for my property, but hey, if you want to pay me for it, that's fine. I'll take that money and 1031 it into something else. So, and that's the kind of market we're in right now. It's, you know, people are, in my opinion, overpaying. So anyhow, that's one thing. Get long-term financing, long-term fixed financing. And if you can, have financing that's long-term and does a reset, meaning that at the end of whatever your fixed period is, it actually doesn't balloon, it doesn't come due, but it may reset relative to an index or something like that, if you can get that. So that's one thing. The other thing is that from my perspective, if you have the long-range financing and you are in a decent market where even if the economy goes down a bit, you know, it doesn't turn into a ghost town or anything like that. Generally speaking, and this is what happened in the last downturn in the 2008 time period, generally speaking, the market value of the property will go down percentage-wise more than the rents will go down, especially in this last market turn. And if something similar happened, then there's a good likelihood, because there's so much demand right now for rental properties, and it, you know, so many different reasons for it. I could go into that, but it's so there's not a reason to expect a significant decline in rental demand, although the rents may go down some. So basically, if you can buy in a cash flow market with a cash flow property, it doesn't matter if your property value goes down. You just ride it out. You know, simple as that. That's what I did when I've never had a problem with any of my properties. You know, I have a perfect payment record, including through 2008 and 2012, you know, and the properties I had before that. Now the value of my properties went down, but I don't care. Maybe my
those book values, right?
What's so that?
I said it's kind of like, you know, in the stock market, the concept of the book value, you know, or not necessarily the you know, the paper value was going down, but like you said, you've got a long investment horizon, right? So it's kind of the whole retirement planning adage of the volatility of the stock market on a micro scale versus a 30-year timeline. It's nice, smooth, and up and to the right, right? So you
absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And if you can ride it out, if you have the financing in place and you have enough buffer in your rents, then you just ride it out. Simple as that. I mean, if anything, your property taxes go down, you know?
Right. Well, and when you're underwriting, you know, if you're underwriting a deal tomorrow, are you underwriting for, you know, some of those negative market conditions? Or are you, you know, I'm guessing I know the answer to that, but, you know, how do you, you know, are you, I've heard, you know, for me, if I'm looking at something and okay, maybe cap rates are going up 30 bips a year or something like that as you're holding it, as opposed to what I think a lot of people have done over the last 9 years, which is, you know, assume these strong rental growths, compressing cap rates. And I think right now, if I'm underwriting something, you know, I'm kind of thinking the opposite. And then if the roller coaster continues, then so much better for me. Right. But then maybe you don't get stuck.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for myself personally, I'm a cash flow investor. So appreciation is just a cherry on top. Simple as that. And appreciation is actually, I like it, but I like it because I do cash out refis. So it's not because I'm selling the property. So I'm taking the cash out and then putting it into a new property to expand my portfolio. So yeah, it's all about cash flow. So I'm buying properties right now that cash flow well, and they have buffer in them where if the rents went down, that's okay. I mean, I don't want them to go down to zero kind of thing, but it's, you know, but at the same time, you know, they have more buffer than most. And that's why I don't play in markets like Seattle, because they have no cash flow to start with. And then if the value goes down and if there's a rent dip, then they're all in trouble. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like a good strategy, and it's definitely one that's worked for you. So I'm just trying to soak up as much of that as I can. So, but if you're talking to somebody that's just getting started, what advice, you know, might you, now that you know what you know now, what would you wish someone would have told you when you started? I mean, what kind of advice would you give to beginners, you know, regardless of the market that we're in?
Yeah, for me, I would have started earlier on. Actually, two things. I'll finish my first sentence and then add a little bit. I would have started earlier on partnering with others. In other words, the OPM, the other people's money principle. So that, for instance, the biggest thing that I wish I had done was in the 2008 to 2012 timeframe was to have syndicated them. I didn't have nearly as much experience as I do now. So, and frankly, I wasn't as aware of it at that point. I'm very extremely aware. I'm very knowledgeable on it at this point. But at the same time, that was a big missed opportunity. Now, I wouldn't say that an absolute beginner start out with syndication. I definitely would not say that. I'd say get experience under your belt, start with smaller properties, partner with others where you're the partner and they're the GP, the general partner, you know, things like that, to get some experience first. But try to get into that sooner if you're trying to go big and and you know, if you really want to. And the other thing is that I could have you know, quit my W-2 job earlier, just in terms of having built up enough income and equity and all that kind of stuff. I certainly could have. And I would say in retrospect, I probably should have, you know, just to devote myself even more to real estate. I mean, it had its benefits, you know, not just literal benefits like healthcare benefit, health insurance benefits and stuff like that. But it also, the nice part about working a W-2 job was that, it was easier to get some kind of loans, at least for smaller properties. And it also allowed me to pay all of my living expenses plus more than that for savings off of my W-2. And then just everything from my real estate was just rolled back into the real estate, you know. So it did allow me to snowball faster. But I'd say those two things, you know, as far as partnering with others and then making the commitment. If you're really committed, commit and jump in earlier. Those would probably be the two things I would do different.
Now, you offer something a little bit unique in terms of consulting, from what I understand. And so, can you talk a little bit about how you're using the hard-earned experience that you do have to help others on an on-demand basis, or you know, how does that work in terms
sure.
of consulting?
Yeah. That actually was created organically with others or through others. I actually did not intend to get into coaching or consulting for others. That wasn't part of my plan. And people came to me and asked if I did coaching. And at first I said no. And then after a while I said, well, actually, not only can it be fun and interesting and just a neat experience to work with somebody and see them grow and help them grow, that is somewhat, you know, satisfying and interesting to do, but there's the aspect that actually teaching others keeps you personally sharp. And, you know, when they're asking me questions, I need to make sure it's right. And if it's not, I mean, sometimes I get asked a question that I don't know. Yeah, most of them I do, but not all the time. And then I go off and research it and I come back and I tell them what the answer is, you know. And it really helps me personally just make sure that I've got a real clear, you know, vision and strategy and can really communicate it and things like that. So when I started thinking about that, I said, well, maybe I should do this, but I didn't want to get into some guru program and I didn't want to get, you know, that just wasn't my thing. So what I said to the people that I've been coaching is, as I literally do it on an hourly basis. In other words, and it's as much or as little as they want, and which is great. There's no pressure. You know, somebody can consult with me for literally just a few hours and done. You know, they can test it out, whatever. And the next meeting is always up to them. You know, so what I've done with some people is I've helped them learn new concepts at a high level, and that might just be once every couple of weeks or once a month or whatever, whenever they want. And then when they get into a deal, then they may hire me for more hours to help them with due diligence. And, you know, would you do this? And can you help me with the numbers and the finances and how should I get financing on this? And, you know, how to work it as a overall deal with their partners and all that kind of stuff. And then it might get more intense, and it's just completely flexible. And it works great for me because I'm not making some commitment. I still got my time flexibility, and it works great for them because it's very little commitment on their part. So it's different than most. Most of them are like more of like a set fee, and they're ridiculous amount of money on an annual basis. And,
I was going to say it can get as cheap or as expensive as you want. I've seen the gamut. I've seen, you know, 50 to 100K upfront plus, you know, a nominal fee hourly, you know. I was told one time I was at an exchange, I think it was a Charlie's Sub. I was getting lunch somewhere in Europe. When I was stationed in Europe, and it was breakfast, and they said they were out of toast, and I had ordered a combo that included toast, and they said, well, just throw me a pancake or something, and they said, no, the pancake is extra. I said, well, yeah, but I got toast. They said, no, the toast was free. It came for free with the combo, and I said, that's not how it works. You know, I said, that's not how it works. I'm not an idiot. It's not, you know, it's not free.
Yeah.
So yeah,
they're not big on their customer service strategy.
No, it's not. It was the bottom of the barrel. But anyways, that sounds cool. That is cool. I identify with that mindset of, you know, it works for you, it works for them, and you're not asking for a big commitment. And I think that's a good point about how it keeps you sharp, because in other areas of my life, I've definitely experienced that, and the power of being responsible for teaching something in terms of keeping your own skills sharp is definitely a powerful thing to recognize for you. So that's cool that it's working out for you. So let's move into, when I read through your background, it sounds like you have a wide diversity of experience. There was something that jumped out at me about being over in Europe for a little bit. Feel free to talk about that. I was curious, but the wide variety of relationships that it seems like you've built, how has that served you in real estate? And kind of talk about the value of relationships in this business. So kind of two questions is, what's the value of relationships? You know, it probably can't be overstated, but what do you think about it? And then has your specific background helped you more or less than maybe staying in one vertical your whole experience?
Right. Yeah, I'll start with the second part, just kind of broadly as far as experience, because I think it's a good point that you're bringing up in terms of how somebody's background can relate to real estate. And some people, I've heard some people say, well, they don't have a background, a quote, background in real estate. How do I get started? Should I even get started? You know, as if they think somebody is born out of the womb with, you know, a real estate license or a broker's license or whatever it is they think that some people have. And really, there are a lot of transferable skills. And that's the most important thing, is to look at what kind of a background that you have personally and what are the transferable skills that you can bring to real estate. So it might not be getting $1 million loans and $10 million loans and hire for a big multifamily. But you may, like in my case, the things that I brought with me were, again, I was primarily in program management and team management positions. And that ability to work with others, orchestrate others, and manage others is key. It's critical to real estate in terms of keeping all the balls juggled. You know, you've got lots of balls in the air and you got to keep juggling them. And also being able to work with lots of different types of people, being able to manage contractors and property managers and even tenants and all that kind of stuff. So all those transferable skills are really important. And anybody who's thinking about getting into it, think about those transferable skills, because those are the things that you can start to build on. You know, it's not just technical knowledge in real estate, and which is to your second question of relationships. So, yeah, I mean, I have learned a lot in terms of the technical side of real estate over the years. However, to your question about relationships, that's really critical. I mean, my last two deals that I've been working on, they were both brought to me by people who I made relationships. And it wasn't a, you know, conniving kind of, you know, here's a relationship, I hope that you'll do something for me kind of thing. It was just, you know, people I've worked with, I helped them out, they've helped me out, you know, we always like seeing each other, you know, it's that kind of thing. And they brought me off market deals. And right now in today's market, that can be really important. Not every off market deal is good. I get a lot of off market deals that some of them are actually worse than stuff on market. So it's kind of, you know, some people go, oh, I got an off market deal. And it's kind of like, oh, who cares? You know, but you know, every once in a while, an off market deal can be better. And those are through relationships. Also, just in terms of flexibility, I mean, something like, for instance, financing, you know, just in terms of getting some better parameters or better loan that will meet what you need to get that deal all the way to the closing line or the finish line, all the way to closing to the finish line can be key. There's lots of things where relationships really come in. So and that's something I've had to learn really over time because, you know, I learned a lot at first, but then I kind of had to get out of my shell, so to speak, and also get out there and meet people. And I found that although I learned a lot in books and going to courses, I learned even more when I was out, you know, talking to other investors and having a conversation.
Now, how's your experience been? And this is not a trick question. How's your experience been working with your wife, building up on Volo, and then I've got a follow up question after that. But how's that been?
Yeah, it's been great. Not a trick question. It's been right. Great. So basically, what I did was, and again, part of that vision board was the idea that real estate would be our business. Although she didn't have a personal interest in it. I have a personal interest in it. I enjoy it. It's not just it's definitely not a job, you know, J-O-B, so to speak. It is a business, and it's a business that I really like. I like all the intricacies of it and how it works. And she has a background that had a number of transferable skills that are of interest to us building the business. And how it came in with her was, again, part of the vision board. We wanted to move up to this island. This island does not have much economy on its own, so there's not much jobs up here, at least certainly the high-tech jobs that we used to have. And so that was one issue. And then the other thing was basically controlling our time and doing what we want to, and also being a part of building something on our own business. So in general, she was really on board with all those things. You know, if I had gone into some other business and it had also been successful, she probably would have jumped on that too. So, you know, it wasn't, for her, it wasn't specifically real estate. But what we ended up doing was we ended up going to each other's strong suits. And so she is handling more of our property, what I would call our property management side and our accounting side. So she works a lot with our property managers. We don't directly property manage any of our properties except for three that are triple net, and that's just because they're so easy to, you know, for those who are listening who don't know what triple net is, it's basically where the tenant is effectively responsible for everything. I'm kind of simplifying there, but
like the Walgreens and the CVSs of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Maintenance, property taxes, insurance, the landlord might be responsible for structure, but anyhow, there's lots of variations, but anyhow, the main point is there's a few that we have that are just so simple that we don't have a property manager. But other than that, all of ours are professionally property managed. And that allows us to scale, and it also gives us more time freedom. But she, nonetheless, there's still a lot to be done. Even with the property manager, you got to manage the manager, and she does that. I'm involved as well, but she's the main point person for that. And then accounting, and I set up some systems for her, and then she's run with that. And then that allows me to go out and look for new deals, to work on to work with others, to build the business and look at it, that part of our business. So we definitely both do a part of each other's role, but at the same time we've divided it up that way, and it's been really effective, and it's freed up my time. And then for her, like I said, about a year and a half ago, I stopped my W-2 job. She stopped her W-2 job about 5 years ago. So we got to the point of, okay, well, you can stop and now get into the business. So she's actually been full-time about I think it's almost 5 years now. So in our business.
Awesome. And do you have any remote team members or anything like that? I know, you know, a lot of people are using remote. I'm just curious that are using virtual team members and stuff like that these days. Is that?
Yeah. Virtual assistants. I'm looking into that. I do not right now. I have a highly outsourced model, like I said, and that's always been our intent. In other words, like property management and things like that. But right now it's literally as far, we have no employees. It's just the two of us. And everything that we do, I mean, we never swing a hammer. We, you know, never, you know, work directly with a tenant and all that kind of stuff. And that allows us to scale up. And then we're managing the pros, you know, who are out there. And when we get into even bigger and bigger deals, I expect that's going to change. And I've already looked in, I've already started looking into virtual assistants. And I've also looked at direct employees nearby, like sharing an office, but I have not needed to do that yet.
Cool. Yeah, I know a lot of people are they use that for things like acquisition and, but at the level or the scale that you're working at, I mean, it seems like it might be challenging to, you know, you don't want necessarily a VA calling up, you know, apartment owners and things like that, trying to find deals. I'm not sure, but it's definitely an interesting model that technology has enabled that remote team, especially for something like this. You know, you could build a very sizable real estate business with a remote team. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. The two areas that I've thought I'd initially like to use a VA for is one, some of the bookkeeping, even though, like I said, my wife primarily does that, but to free up some of her time so that she can still do the high level accounting kind of stuff, but the smaller, you know, scanning things and, and handling payments and stuff like that, that we could basically, you know, give that to somebody. And then the other aspect is actually doing some due diligence. In other words, some initial checking on a property that I say, okay, I've already set up a system and I've taught a VA how to evaluate a particular property the way I do it. We already actually do have a process for that that my wife and I use. We have it all written down. There's all these things we look at it for any property. And there's a certain number of those steps that I could very easily systematize as long as the person is competent, to a certain, I would want to review it, but spending all the time of getting the information for that, I could potentially give to a VA and instead just review the final info instead of having to go and collect all the info. So those are two areas I'd like to start with. And then the next one would be just what you were talking about, basically helping the pipeline, you know, in terms of ways to, you know, reach out to sellers and things like that. So that would be the way I would likely progress. And then over time, investor management. And then I've already hired some, essentially a VA to help. We're starting a newsletter and things like that, you know, so kind of gradually dipping our toe into it at the moment.
And again, here's a question that there's no wrong answer to, but it doesn't involve your wife, so don't worry. What does it mean to you to go big as an investor?
To me, going big as an investor is all about designing it around your life. And what I mean by that is you can go big by buying 1,000-unit apartment complex, and some people just base it on numbers. But to me, going big is making a commitment to, if we're talking about real estate investing, which we are here, but, you know, investing or being an entrepreneur in general, but for real estate investing, making sure that it fits into, in our case, that bigger vision board. And if you have a bigger, you know, some people say your why, or in our case, our vision board, and you want to go big on that vision board, then think about how real estate can help enable that. You know, real estate is not an end in itself. It's not an end in itself for me, even though I do enjoy it. It's a way to help me do the rest, you know, my bigger goals. And to me, that's going big. If you can look back on your life, you know, many years from now and be really satisfied, happy, minimal regrets, and real estate was a part of enabling you to do that, then my opinion, you went big and you successfully went big.
Awesome. Well, let's move into something a little bit more fun. What do you like to do for fun? You mentioned you like to go outdoors. You know, what kind of stuff do you and your wife like to do for fun, non-real estate related?
Yeah. We're like I said, you know, like you pointed out, outdoorsy. So I enjoy mountain biking, sea kayaking, hiking, backpacking. And we also enjoy a lot of travel. And now that our house is recently built, we're already packing our summer schedule at the moment. So getting everything packed in. We have a lot more opportunity because we control our time a lot more now. So we've always enjoyed travel, and we really enjoy that. And also I enjoy just some more personal, you know, in-home things. I do enjoy some writing, some photography, and reading. I actually, when I read, I bounce between different types of books. So I go from usually real estate book to a personal development book to a business book, and repeat the cycle, and then occasionally I throw in a fiction book. So I think it's really important to not just read about real estate, because it'll help your real estate business a lot if you also look at other things than real estate, especially business at a higher level in terms of systems. So I do reading as well, you know, when I can. We exercise a good bit, and things like that, and of course a lot of family activities as well. I have a 9-year-old daughter. So
yeah, any rock climbing or anything like that out there?
Yes, there is. I've done some of that. I've dabbled in a whole bunch of things. You know, I also do a good bit of cross country skiing, and a whole bunch of different sports. And I've done rock climbing, but I don't do it as actively as those other ones.
I went cross country skiing in Norway one time, really high up in Norway in the winter. And the guy, the Norwegian who was teaching me, said every self-respecting village in Norway has somewhere, even if you can't see it, has their own cross country track somewhere. Just like, I don't know how you equate that in America, but he was right. We would always drive around to different villages and they've got cross country skiing tracks, even if it's just, I don't know, a couple hundred yards in a circle. Every little village has a cross country track there. So,
wow, that must have been beautiful.
It was. I got a dog that helped me go uphill. So it was good. But anyways, I digress. So let's move on to the Go Big Gauntlet. So here's four standard questions that I ask every guest, and the first one is a softball. What's your favorite real estate book?
So the one that had the most, I'm gonna say the one that had the most impact, but it's the one everybody says. So I'll go to another one. So Rich Dad Poor Dad, which everybody says that was a big impact, but because that one's so popular, the one that maybe two, because it's by the same author, Dave Lindahl has written a couple books, Multifamily Millions, and one on emerging markets, and I really got a lot out of those, and just in terms of conceptually and how to approach multifamily as well as how to look at markets. So
that's interesting. I've read within the last 6 months, I've read Lindahl's Multifamily Millions, and I've got the emerging market analysis or whatever it's called on my list. Can you just for selfish reasons, can you tell me a little bit more about the emerging markets book and what you liked about that?
Yeah, it really two things. Number one, it just talks about the macro level things to look at in markets. And like I mentioned earlier, I always start whenever I'm going to purchase a property, I never start with the property. You know, I've turned down 10 cap properties. So, you know, it's like, you know, well, hey, you know, somebody would think, oh, 10 cap property, I'll jump on that. But no, there's a bigger picture there. I always start with the market, and I start very high level, and then I keep going down, down, down until I get to a no, something that's a no. And if I get to the bottom of my list and there's no no's, meaning all yeses, then okay, good. This is one to pursue. And so it gave it gave some really good things just to look at from a macro perspective. And then the other aspect that's interesting about it is it just talks about the cycles that exist, not at the national level, but at the metro and even smaller than metro level. And that's in some ways, one of its main thesis is even when there's either an upturn or a downturn in the national economy, that it generally trends, yes, everywhere, but it's not exactly trending that way everywhere. And one of his things is saying, you know, look at where the market that you're invested in, look at where it is on the the buy versus sell cycle and where it is on the price appreciation cycle, and sell before it reaches the peak, so you're not chasing it downhill, and then reinvest those funds into another place that's a lot lower on the uphill, on the, you know, going uphill in terms of valuation, and just keep repeating that cycle, and don't just be on the national cycle, but actually be on a smaller cycle and think, you know, multi-state, and you know, think about, you know, many more markets certainly than just your backyard.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of actionable strategies. I think he mentions in the book talking about how there's a, you know, there's the right strategy for each cycle of the market, and it's is that kind of what you're describing? How he talks about there's a way to make money in every cycle, part of the cycle.
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
All right. Second question is, what's something that you're glad you failed at?
After I graduated from college, I got into stock day trading, and
it's easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, when I got out of college, I bought a condo and for myself. And then I bought a few years later, I bought a house and I kept the condo. That was my first rental property. And the first tenant was great. The second tenant was not great, sucked. And I did my own property management, and I said, wow, I really thought, because I remember I'd done all this research before, and I said, wow, real estate is the way, you know, so this is my very first little rental property. And it was such a bad experience working with this tenant that I sold the place, and I said, okay, how am I going to make my money now? Because real estate sucks. So I started looking into day trading, and I did well, except that not once, but twice. And my day trading, by the way, was not the one that, you know, every second they're looking at everything. It was more like in the morning before I went to work, I'd buy something, and in the evening I'd see how something did and I'd sell. So it was, you know, it wasn't the serious day trading. But twice during that day while I was at work, a company it was determined that for whatever, in one case they cooked the books and it became public, and so they went from $10 a share down to like $1 a share, and something else similar to that happened with another one, and all of my profits were completely wiped away after like a year of work and just these two trades. And wow, then that really sucked, you know. And I'm glad that I failed at day trading, because it then got me thinking about real estate again. and I realized, for me, the issue was, in that case, I really needed a professional property manager to be between me and that really bad tenant, because I took it very personally, you know, because the person was just, it was not a good person and not a good person to work with. And I, you know, it kind of got under my skin, and I just need somebody who's a pro at, I needed somebody who's a pro at that. When I realized that about myself and about, you know, I was good at every other aspect of it, but dealing with a really bad lying, cheating, stealing kind of tenant was not my forte. Then I was off and running, you know, because then I hired the pros to do it.
All right. If you could go back in time, knowing what you know now, what would you have done sooner?
I kind of hit on that a little bit earlier. Yeah. So I would say, you know, partner with other people and get started earlier. And then I would add to that when I was referencing about syndications, you know, if I did getting started earlier, like I was buying, I wasn't running when other people were in the 2008 to 2012 time period. I was buying as much as I could. But if I had followed that advice of partnering with other people, I would have bought even more. You know, I wanted to buy. I felt confident enough that, yeah, this is a good time to buy while everybody else is running away. I just wish I'd bought more, which is obvious. But then how could you have bought more would be to have partnered with other people. And that's what I would, yeah. I was buying, but I obviously would have liked to have bought a lot more.
Well, last question is what's made you successful in a business where so many others have failed?
I would say perseverance toward my vision board and my whys. And again, that's because real estate fits into a larger jigsaw puzzle. And you know, it's a lifestyle thing for me. It's interesting. It's something that can be lucrative, and it's also something that can help us achieve our non-real estate related goals. And I always kept that in mind. So it was really a matter of, even though I was essentially working two jobs for a lot of years, I kept at it. And when things got hard, or when I didn't know how to do something and I didn't have the information or knowledge or experience at that point, I kept going. And, after I had that initial post-college experience and I realized my mistake, then I was like, okay, I know this is worthwhile. It still makes sense to me. And it doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but at the same time, if I stick with it, keep going and work through any of the hard parts, then it actually becomes easier over time. And it does. It's never easy, but it becomes easier.
Well, awesome. All right. You made it through the gauntlet. So that's an accomplishment. Where can people go to connect and learn more about you and maybe check out your newsletter and sign up for that? And where do you want people to head for that?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to reach me is on my website, because you can find my phone number and my email, all that kind of stuff is all there, as well as information and newsletter and all that. And that is bonvolo.com, which is spelled bonvolo.com. And there's a contact info there, and you can reach out to me any way you'd like.
Well, Scott, I've enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great talking to you as well. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, everyone. That was my interview with Scott Price. It did not disappoint for me. I hope it was awesome for you as well. Scott's an awesome guy. I really just really enjoyed the way that he talked about buying for cash flow and the way that you can focus on the fundamentals. You know, he talks about not even when he gets an opportunity, and now we're talking about really in-depth market analysis, but he talks about when he gets an opportunity, he's not even looking at the property first. You know, he's going starting macro and in terms of demographics and around the property and looking at that actual market. And he's got some very systematized, I can tell he's got very systematized ways of thinking about things and sticks to those systems and those parameters, which I think is especially poignant if you're listening to this in 2019. So definitely one to check out, maybe revisit. And we talk about kind of the full cycle of his experience. And if you want to learn more about Scott, you can check out the show notes with a link to his website. He's got an awesome newsletter going, so I would definitely encourage you to check that out as well. If you want to learn more about me, you can go to gobigrealestatepodcast.com. The one ask I do have of you is if you could hit pause, look on your podcast player, go to the subscribe button, click subscribe so you're notified of all the latest episodes, and if you wouldn't mind just leaving a review, leave an honest review. That really helps me out in getting the show going and getting everything moving. So I appreciate you. I know you have a lot of options when it comes to what podcast you're listening to. So thank you for being here today. And I will continue to work to bring you valuable content each and every week. All right. Until next time, this is your host, Hunter Locke, signing off.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Go Big Real Estate Podcast. Find show notes, links, and more tips on going big at www.gobigrealestatepodcast.com.